Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Ben Sidran, a jazz musician and academic who's written an excellent new book called Jews, Music, and the American Dream. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. I just returned from a short trip to New York City, the largest Jewish city in the world. There are roughly 2 million Jews in the New York metropolitan area, a multiple of any other Jewish city in the entire earth, and the sheer volume of Jewish life is astounding. There are more interesting synagogues in New York than you can possibly visit, and from your first bite of a hand-sliced, thick-cut pastrami sandwich, you know you aren't in Tucson anymore, or even Chicago or Los Angeles. As comedian Lenny Bruce once said, if you're from New York and you're Catholic, you're still Jewish. If you're from Butte, Montana and you're Jewish, you're still Goyish. No, I don't mean that in a bad way. Look, I tell you these obvious facts not because I suspect you are unaware of the intense Jewishness of New York City, but because for those of us who live in other, less Jewish cities, like, say, Tel Aviv, the very unremarkability of the depth of Jewish life in Gotham is pretty stunning when you visit. There are more really good Jewish museums in New York than in the rest of the country combined, I think, and of course, better kosher and Jewish food than anywhere else in the U.S. There is more going on culturally in New York in general than anywhere else, of course, and so much of that is also Jewish that it can seem truly overwhelming. But mostly, it's just a lot of fun. Like a bar mitzvah buffet of excellent delicacies spread out before you to enjoy. Now, I'm not saying that New York is a purely Jewish city. Of course, that's not true. The habits of this season of the year are certainly very much in evidence in New York, where everything is enshrouded in the same tinsel and carol overlay that envelops the whole of America. Only in New York, of course, it's bigger. But with all the craziness around Rockefeller Center and in the store windows of Bloomingdale's and Macy's, there are still lots of folks who clearly aren't focused on the Christian religious holiday season, since so many of them aren't Christians or celebrating Christmas. Or at least not in the same way that actual Christians do. Of course, there is the traditional Christmas Eve New York Jewish experience. Get great Chinese food and watch a movie. Which we did, naturally. And on December 25th, Jewish museums are open with special celebrations for kids and adults. And it's very easy to get a cab in New York on December 24th or 5th, since most of the cabbies seem to come from the Indian subcontinent these days, where Krishna and Allah are much more likely to be the subject of worship than the theoretical birthday of a Jewish boy from the Galil. So anyway, while in New York, we had the privilege of seeing a fabulous display at the Jewish Museum of manuscripts from the Oxford University's famed Bodleian Library. These were mostly Hebrew and Aramaic manuscripts from the Middle Ages up to the Renaissance, and they included a series of extraordinary treasures. Not one, but two manuscripts of Moses Maimonides' Mishneh Torah, written in his own hand in the 12th century with his own corrections on that seminal work of Jewish law. Handwritten texts by Ramban, Nachmanides, and Rashi, two of the greatest biblical commentators of all. Gorgeous, illuminated Hebrew Bibles with fantastic illustrations in gold leaf and vermilion and purple. Beautiful, miniature micro-calligraphy Bibles and prayer books from the 13th century, and many other world textual treasures on display in a converted mansion of a museum on Fifth Avenue. An incredible exhibit and wonderful to see and experience in person, and definitely proof that we were not in Kansas anymore. We also saw two of the most remarkable synagogue structures in the whole world, Temple Emmanuel and Central Synagogue, just a few blocks from each other on the east side of Manhattan. Temple Emmanuel is a cathedral-like building, seating a mere 4,500 people for services, in a space very much reminiscent of Chartres or Notre Dame in France. Huge, intimidating, beautiful, austere. Central Synagogue is also huge, but in a much warmer Moorish style, and it was restored and rebuilt not too long ago after a disastrous fire that actually catalyzed the whole congregation. Both these synagogues have huge memberships, although few actual people were there to pray on a holiday season Reform Saturday morning service, and Central Synagogue has capped its membership at a mere 2,500 families, and now has a 3-year waiting list just to get in. Not the exact same problem all temples in America are experiencing right now. There are certain small aspects of Jewish New York that reveal other differences. For one thing, the average synagogue musician in New York, whether at B'nai Jeshurun, where we attended services Friday night, or at Central or Emmanuel, that is, the average Jewish working musician in New York would be the best musician in just about any other synagogue in the world, perhaps save Los Angeles. We heard a great cellist, a magnificent cantor, several outstanding keyboard players, a wonderful clarinetist, excellent percussionist, fabulous guitarist, and so on, all in just 3 not especially large musical ensembles playing in these Reform and Conservative synagogues. If music moves you to prayer, you should pray better in New York, because the music is just flat out better. And so, to play us in on this fine morning and this final Two Jewish show of the secular 2012 year, here's a vocal piece from B'nai Jeshurun on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. That was from B'nai Jeshurun, BJ, singing Kol HaNeshama, My Whole Soul Praises God. When we come back on Two Jewish, our guest, Ben Sidran, will explore what has made it possible for so much of American popular music to be created by Jews. Find out in a few moments on Two Jewish.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. You know, it's common knowledge that what's large to one person may appear small to another. Take pizza, for example. Some places sell a, quote, large pizza for a pretty large price. Then surprise, you get it home, it barely feeds 3 people. Some places sell you 2 large pizzas for the price of 1. Believe me, they can't be too large unless they're using real cheap ingredients. But that's a subject for another commercial. Anyway, at Mama's, we think our family-sized pizza should be the yardstick for measuring all pizzas. In fact, you need a yardstick to measure it. The bottom line is that pizza size is all relative. And on behalf of all my relatives, we invite you to Mama's to try one of our pizzas, no matter what size. After all, every Mama's pizza has a taste that's huge. Mama's Pizza with 4 convenient locations. You can check them all out at mamasfamous.com. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza!
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome the two Jewish art guests this morning, Ben Sidran. Although best known for writing Steve Miller's hit song Space Cowboy, that's a few years ago, Ben Sidran's more widely recognized as the host of NPR's jazz series Jazz Alive, which has received a Peabody Award, which is a big deal in this industry. He's host of VH1 TV's New Vision series and has produced 25 solo albums as a pianist, producer, singer, and composer, including one that was nominated for a Grammy. He's worked with many of the biggest names in jazz and pop, Van Morrison, Diana Ross, and others, John Hendricks. He composed the soundtrack for the acclaimed film Hoop Dreams, and we're talking to him mostly because of his book, There Was a Fire, Jews, Music, and the American Dream, published in 2012. Welcome. Good morning.
Good morning, Rabbi. Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about the connection, because obviously, you know, many of us know that Jews have been part of the creation of American popular music for a long time. How did that start, and what does it mean?
Well, you know, the great wave of Jewish immigration to the United States began in the early 1880s as the Jews were fleeing the pogroms in the Pale of Settlement, Eastern Russia, essentially. And Jews who came to the United States were just looking for the main chance. They had not been citizens back in Poland, Latvia, Lithuania, where they had come from. They were poor. They were rural, very much unlike the German Jews who had come to America before that. And when they got to the United States, one of the great opportunities that was opening up, along with others like clothing, they had skills at sewing, this sort of thing, was this idea of songwriting. And many of the early American popular song composers and publishers were Jews from this generation, directly out of the Pale of Settlement. A classic example is Irving Berlin, who came to the United States as a young boy from Siberia, spoke only Yiddish. By the time he was 19 years old, he had written his first hit song, and shortly thereafter, Alexander's Ragtime Band, which was a huge hit song, and was remarkable in that the language of that song was one of the first examples of slang, of American slang making its way into a popular song. So they not only came prepared to try to stay alive in any way they could and took up this pennies business of songwriting, but they also identified with the crowd. Irving Berlin was famous for saying, "The mob is never wrong," and that's how it began.
And of course, Irving Berlin's the guy who wrote, appropriate to this season, White Christmas. We'll talk about the Jewish influence on American popular music and really a terrific book, There Was a Fire, Jews, Music, and the American Dream, with our guest Ben Sidran when we come back on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business.
For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Attention, Arizona income taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime by directing your tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. Here's how. State of Arizona allows taxpayers to get a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations who provide scholarships for kids in kindergarten through 12th grade to go to qualified private schools. JETCO provides a quality Jewish education to children in need at Congregation Anshe Israel Kindergarten, the Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, Temple Emmanuel's Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy. If you pay Arizona state income tax and make your contribution to JETCO, you'll get 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax return. Join over 750 supporters last year who gave money to JETCO and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income tax. New this year, there's an additional tax credit, the switcher credit. It increases the maximum donation you can make to JETCO to $1,003 for single filers and $2,006 for married couples filing jointly. When we fight every day for the continuity of the Jewish people, take advantage of this great opportunity. JETCO is one way to foster a Jewish identity for our community's kids. Contributions to JETCO have helped hundreds of children receive financial aid in order to get a Jewish education. Call 647-8442, again, 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Give the gift of education. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website or download us from there at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Guy.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
Last week you were talking about the great festival of festivals in Haifa, your native city, the Chag Shel HaChagim it's called?
It is.
And you mentioned a story about the reason that you became a shliach representing Israel in America had to do with something that happened at one of these celebrations which celebrates both Hanukkah, Christmas, Eid al-Fitr, the whole of Jewish, Muslim, and Christian holidays all rolled into one.
Indeed. I was walking through the Chag of the Chagim with my whole family. And, the story started a week before. A week before I went to the Chag of the Chagim, I took my kids to a playground. And while they were playing, a nice lady approached me and told me, "Hey, Guy, how are you? What's up?" I was looking up at her. Took me a while to remember where do I know her from. Apparently, when I was an 11th grader, and I was at the Israeli Scouts, I was in charge of her age group, and she was a 5th grader there. Haven't seen her since then. We start chatting, and then she told me that she just came back from the States because her husband was a shaliach in Cincinnati. She started telling me what a shaliach is, and I felt this urge feeling inside that, hey, that's something I want to do. Went back home, told my wife. She said, "Okay, you're crazy. Go to sleep. You'll forget all about it, and we'll continue our lives." Then we toured the Chag of the Chagim with all the family. Suddenly, that same lady with her entire family comes on, you know, towards us, and we meet them again. And she started talking to me about being a shaliach. And she said, "Have you thought about it?" And my wife looks at her and says, "Oh, you are the one bringing those crazy ideas to him." So she looks at my wife and says, "You know what? Let's go drink some coffee." She took my wife to drink coffee. I was with the kids. An hour later, my wife comes back and says, "Okay, you need to sign to write your CV and send it over. You need to sign up to be. That's a great thing to do. Let's go for it." That would make me a shaliach, basically. So it was, you know, some would say it was heavenly decided.
That's right. It was bashert. It was kismet. You know, it was meant to be. Well, we are certainly glad that it turned out that way. How long was the process to become a shaliach for you?
It's about a year process from the minute you
hand in your application.
You give your application. There is a very long process of interviews. You go through, if I remember correctly, about 5 interviews. You go through a seminar, a weekend-long seminar where they observe your behavior in a group and in giving classes and stuff like that. You have a psychological assessment. You have some written exams in English, in other elements, and managing and stuff like that. Yeah, it was long. It was really long.
sounds like they could use that process to pick rabbis, too. Wow. Guy, thanks very much. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We started speaking last week about the Palestinian status at the UN, which is non-member observer status. That's what was, they were sort of upgraded to that status just recently. Tell us what that means, or at least what it might mean in the context of some of the history that you gave us last week.
All right. Well, there are states or political entities at the UN which, for one reason or another, have observer status but are not considered members. And another example is the Vatican, which chooses not to be a member. In fact, one of the few organizations of which the Vatican is a member is the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, for which I worked in Vienna for 4.5 years. It's interesting that, and you know the joke, I've told you that the Vatican representative there always said, after I spoke, because I almost always quoted from the Old Testament, he would always say to me, "If only you would come over to our side, we would make you a cardinal. I guarantee it." Anyway, but Switzerland is another good example. Switzerland belongs to several of the specialized agencies of the UN, like the Universal Postal Union or the World Health Organization. It is not a member state of the UN by choice. It sees that as somehow an infringement on its neutrality. Of course, it makes a lot of money by hosting a whole array of UN organizations. Now, the Palestinian Authority would love to be a member state. It has not yet been granted that status, in part because the nature of its statehood, in quotation marks, is so vague, tenuous, debatable, etc. It's a Palestinian Authority. And the UN General Assembly actually created a committee, and I will actually read this to you so that I get it right word for word, a committee on the exercise of the inalienable rights of the Palestinian people. This was mandated by the UN General Assembly to promote the realization of the inalienable rights of the Palestinian people, comma, to support the peace process for the achievement of a two-state solution on the basis of pre-1967 borders and the just realization of all final status issues, and to mobilize assistance to the Palestinian people. All right, so there is a committee in the UN mandated by the General Assembly to basically do what could have happened in 1947 and 1948 if the neighboring states around Israel had not denied the Palestinian people the rights that were being accorded to them by the UN General Assembly 65 years ago. 65 years of tragic history, I might add. And one of the things that makes this whole set of issues so complicated today is that those Palestinians who fled, either because they felt threatened by Israelis or, in most cases, because Arab propaganda encouraged them to flee and gave them the illusion that it would be a very temporary flight, right? So they have lived outside of Israel since 1947 or 1948. And in many cases, they have children and grandchildren who have not ever been labeled as anything other than Palestinians. They've not been fully integrated into Egypt or Jordan or Syria or Lebanon or England or wherever they may live. They identify as Palestinians, but they've never been to Palestine. They have no idea what they're looking at. And so the notion of them going home to a home they've never known, or the right to return, becomes a very complex one. It's very emotional, obviously, for everybody concerned. And there's also the question of reciprocity. What about all the Jews who were forced to leave Iraq or Syria or Egypt or Libya? Do they have a right to return? Could they go home? I mean, these are all questions that are involved in the so-called final status issues. It's more complicated than just a two-state solution of leaving people where they are now. And, you know, there's history, there's emotion, there's sentimentality, there's everything involved.
Boy, you know, it never gets simpler, does it? Maybe next year. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, a final one for 2012. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. One day, Jacob asks his wife, Yetta, "You always carry a picture of me in your purse. What on earth do you want with my photo?" "Well," says Yetta, "whenever I encounter a problem, no matter how impossible it seems at first, I look at your picture, and the problem doesn't seem like a problem any longer. It just melts away." Jacob smiles with pride. "It doesn't really surprise me, Yetta," he says. "Haven't I always told you how miraculous and powerful I am for you?" "Yes, you have," replies Yetta, "and it works like this. I take your picture out of my purse, I look at your face, and I say to myself, what problem can there be that's greater than this?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now, a word of Torah. This week we begin reading Exodus, the second book of the Torah, with the great portion of Shmot. I admit to being a bit biased, as this was my own Bar Mitzvah Torah portion, but certainly Shmot is one of the greatest sections of the Torah. It begins with a kind of coda on Genesis, recounting how the first family of Bereshit, made up of Jacob, his many sons and their descendants, all moved down to Egypt, where Joseph is the effective ruler of the country. They settle in Goshen in the north and flourish there. And then the fateful events that set the future of our people begin. Joseph and his generation pass away, as happens to all of us. A new dynasty takes over in Egypt, which doesn't remember Joseph and his contributions to the country, and the Israelites are now viewed differently. As they grow in numbers and wealth, a new pharaoh worries. The immigrants might serve as a fifth column in the event of invasion. They speak a different language, worship a different god. Their hair is curlier, their nose is larger, their skin a bit darker, perhaps. They certainly have funny accents. They look like trouble. Isn't it interesting how history is a way of repeating itself? How the same negative stereotypes and wicked ways of looking at immigrants recur? And so the Egyptians enslave the Israelites, setting them to work as unpaid slave labor, building store cities, not pyramids, by the way, for the royal government. They set up overseers called taskmasters, establish work quotas, push them harder and harder and harder, essentially try to work them to death. When that fails, the Hebrews are tougher than the Egyptians expect. They decide simply to kill all the male babies, eliminating the whole masculine population in one generation. But the Jews are a little too crafty for their oppressors. In the tribe of Levi, later to be the priestly tribe, a woman hides her newborn boy baby until his cries are too loud to be stifled. She puts him into a tiny ark, a new Noah, and sets him a sail in the Nile River. And when the Pharaoh's daughter pulls him from the river and names him Moses, a remarkable personal story is truly begun. Shmot tells of the early life and adolescence of Moses, too, his instinctive outrage at injustice, his hot temper, his exile to the Sinai. It shows him maturing, marrying, fathering children in the desert as a shepherd. And then it takes him through the dramatic narrative of the burning bush, an encounter with the commanding God that will bring him back into the crucible of history, lead him to become the greatest liberator the world had ever known. Finally, it'll bring him back to Egypt to meet his brother Aaron and shape his destiny and ours. There's almost too much in this portion to grasp. Encapsulating as it does so many of the formative tales of our people's religious history, but most importantly, unlike so many other traditions' hero stories, Exodus does not make Moses a god, or even a perfect paragon. He is just a man, a great, flawed man, born into a conflict not of his own making, rising to that greatness only through trial and error, learning both how to follow God and how to lead people towards justice and freedom. It's a great story, of course, but more than that, it's a powerful lesson. Moses becomes the model for every truly great leader thereafter, in large part because of his very humanness, his ability to empathize with the suffering of the downtrodden and utilize the power of righteousness and God to accomplish everything. May we come to understand as well that we can accomplish great things if we choose, in spite of our own imperfections and limitations, to fight for justice, freedom, and truth. When we come back on Too Jewish, our guest, Ben Sidran, an accomplished jazz and pop musician and academic and the author of an excellent new book about Jews and popular music, will explain why it was Jewish composers and lyricists who best explored the American dream. Hear all about it on Too Jewish in a moment.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace. But sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114. We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Israeli authorities have indicted a former chief rabbi of the country on charges of fraud and breach of trust. Eliyahu Bakshi Doron was charged last week as part of what has become known as the Rabbi's File affair. Bakshi Doron and others are accused of falsifying rabbinical certificates for more than 1,000 soldiers and police officers so they could become eligible for salary increases. The indictment says that as a result, hundreds of millions of shekels were fraudulently awarded from the state without justification. The 71-year-old Bakshi Doron served as one of Israel's two chief rabbis between 1998 and 2003. The chief rabbinate oversees many elements of Jewish religious life and personal status in Israel. The religious equality group Chidush called the indictment further proof that the institution of the chief rabbinate is unnecessary, which was kind of understated for them.
Somewhere over the rainbow, way up high, and the dreams that you dream of once in a lullaby.
Last week, Israel lost one of its best friends in the U.S. Congress with the passing of Senator Daniel Inouye of Hawaii, the 9-term senator who sold Israel bonds at one point and once considered converting to Judaism, died at the age of 88. Inouye's final word was aloha. Inouye, a liberal Democrat, was the senior member of the U.S. Senate, the second longest-serving senator in the history of the august chamber, and its president pro tempore, making him third in line to the presidency. He was also chairman of the powerful Appropriations Committee, and for many years was chairman, or top Democrat, on the Foreign Operations and Defense subcommittees, where he played a pivotal role in advancing U.S.-Israel relations. He once said that he sold Israel bonds to help work his way through college, and he'd even considered converting to Judaism, but he joked that he didn't convert, because being Japanese and having only one arm, he had enough tzoras. The real reason may have been his devoutly Methodist mother, by the way. Inouye's integrity, quiet modesty, and firm belief in bipartisan cooperation won him the admiration and trust of the whole Senate, nowhere more than among the supporters and people of Israel, where he was affectionately nicknamed Trumpledore for the one-armed early Zionist hero Joseph Trumpledore, who died in the 1920 Battle of Tel Chai in the Upper Galil. Inouye lost his right arm in Italy in the closing days of World War II. For his heroism in the Great War, Lieutenant Inouye was awarded the Medal of Honor, but it took 55 years to get that recognition because Japanese-American Nisei servicemen were denied appropriate recognition for their heroism at that time because of their race. The badly injured Inouye, his arm was amputated in a field hospital without anesthetic, was sent to recuperate in Percy Jones Army Hospital in Battle Creek, Michigan, where he became friends with two other wounded GIs who went on to be lifelong friends and serve with Inouye in the Senate, Bob Dole and Philip Hart. When he lost his arm, he lost his dream of becoming a surgeon and so turned to public service. He was elected the first full member of Congress from Hawaii in 1959 when it became a state. He was also the first Japanese-American in the House and later the first in the Senate, becoming eventually the highest-ranking Asian-American politician in American history, at least to this point. Throughout his career, he enjoyed close ties to the Jewish community in Hawaii and nationally, and Inouye was consistently one of Israel's staunchest supporters. His combat experience of a segregated Japanese-American unit in Europe in World War II and learning about the Holocaust affected his worldview ever after. When he recovered after the war, he studied Jewish history. He was a man who saw two injustices, genocide against Native Americans and against Europe's Jews, and he wanted to make sure the Native Americans got help in their restoration and that Israel had America's support in securing itself against those who did not wish Israel's population well, said Tom Dine, the former executive director of AIPAC. He believed in Israel's nobility. Hawaii's governor, Democrat Neil Abercrombie, named his Jewish lieutenant governor, Brian Schatz, a former chair of the Hawaii Democratic Party, to replace Daniel Inouye in the U.S. Senate. Schatz, who is 40, now becomes the 11th Jewish senator in this Congress. He campaigned for President Obama in his native Hawaii in 2008, and for a time, Schatz was the CEO of Helping Hands Hawaii, a social services provider. Inouye had told Abercrombie that his preferred successor would have been U.S. Congresswoman Colleen Hanabusa. Inouye's office said it was disappointed, but wished Schatz the best of luck, but stopped short of saying Mazel Tov.
Well, I see trees of green and red roses too. I watch them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
In a follow-up story from the arrest last week of Rabbi Elise Frischman and other women at the Kotel, the Western Wall, for wearing tallises, and amid outrage across the diaspora over Israel's flurry of recent arrests of women seeking to pray at the Kotel wearing tallises, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has asked Natan Sharansky, chairman of the Jewish Agency, to study the issue and suggest ways to make the site more accommodating to all Jews. This move comes after more than two decades of civil disobedience by women of the wall against regulations, legislation, and a 2003 Israeli Supreme Court ruling that allows for gender divisions at the wall, Judaism's holiest site, and prohibits women from carrying a Torah or wearing talitot there. Although the movement has struggled to gain traction in Israel, where the ultra-Orthodox retain great sway, the issue has deepened the divide between Israel and the Jewish diaspora at a time when Israel is battling international isolation, as always. Critics, particularly leaders of the reform and conservative movements in the U.S., complain that the government's recent aggressive enforcement of restrictions at the wall is turning a national monument into an ultra-Orthodox shul. The Prime Minister thinks the Western Wall has to be a site that expresses the unity of the Jewish people, both inside Israel and outside the State of Israel, said Ron Dermer, Netanyahu's senior advisor. He wants to preserve the unity of world Jewry. This is an important component of Israel's strength. Natan Sharansky, whose quasi-governmental nonprofit handles immigration for the state and is a bridge between Israel and Jews around the world. That's, of course, the Jewish Agency, said that Netanyahu asked him last week to take up the matter. He expected to have recommendations within a few months. That agenda will include improvements for Robinson's Arch, the area of the wall designated for co-ed prayer under the court ruling. That's also where people do B'nai Mitzvah, as I did last June. And the easing of restrictions in the larger area known as the Kotel Plaza, along with the more sensitive questions regarding prayer at the actual Kotel. Sharansky said the Jewish Agency itself stopped having ceremonies for new immigrants in the Kotel Plaza about 2 years ago after the Western Wall Heritage Foundation, which controls the site, said that men and women could not sit together. Under pressure from international groups, the Jewish Agency on October 30th passed a resolution calling for a satisfactory approach to the issue of prayer at the Kotel. Asked whether he could imagine a day when women would wear prayer shawls and read the Torah at the wall itself, Sharansky said, I imagine very easily a situation where everybody will have their opportunity to express their solidarity with Judaism and the Jewish people in the State of Israel in a way he or she wants, without undermining the other. That's as much as I want to say at this moment, Sharansky added, pretty eloquent nonetheless. Now I have to share this vision with the appropriate bodies. Good luck. And actor Jack Klugman, who made an art of gruffness in TV's The Odd Couple and Quincy M.E., has died at the age of 90. In the classic 70s sitcom The Odd Couple, Klugman played sloppy sports writer Oscar Madison, the co-star Tony Randall's Felix, a fussy photographer. The original movie roles were played by Walter Matthau and Jack Lemmon, but in some ways Jack Klugman and Tony Randall were better. Both Klugman and Randall were Jewish, of course. In Quincy M.E., which aired from 76 to 83, Klugman played an idealistic, tough-minded medical examiner, kind of the first of the coroner shows, if you think about it. Although The Odd Couple was never an actual ratings hit during its great five-year run, it is recognized today as a TV classic. Klugman won two Emmys for The Odd Couple, Randall won one, and Jack Klugman was nominated often as well for Emmys for Quincy. Klugman lost his voice to throat cancer in the 1980s, but trained himself to speak again without one vocal cord. He returned to acting in 1993 on Broadway. Jack Klugman split his time between TV, movies like Goodbye Columbus and When Do We Eat, and the New York stage. In his later years, he guest starred on TV series including Third Watch. Alav HaShalom. May he rest now in peace. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish this morning our guest, Ben Sidran. He is a very well-known jazz singer, pianist, producer, composer, having recorded 25 solo albums, including the Grammy-nominated Concert for Garcia Lorca. He might be best known, at least until now, for writing Steve Miller's hit song Space Cowboy and for hosting NPR's landmark jazz series Jazz Alive, which received a Peabody Award, also hosted VH Television's New Visions series, and received the ACE Award for Best Music Series. The book we're talking about today is called There Was a Fire, Jews, Music, and the American Dream. So we started speaking about Irving Berlin, about whom there are, boy, not nearly as many stories as there were Irving Berlin songs, but there sure are a lot of stories. He used to apparently host one of the largest Christmas parties in Hollywood. Was the Jewish adoption of American popular music as an important form of public expression a real big part of American assimilation for Jews?
Well, the interesting thing, they once asked Irving Berlin in an interview what being Jewish has to do with his success as a songwriter, and he said, absolutely nothing. I'm an American. I write American songs. Gershwin said the same thing. I write American music. These were people who were very happy to get away from an oppressive Jewish culture that had grown up in the Pale of Settlement, and to become Americans, to become citizens, was everything, to be a Yankee Doodle Dandy. However, you know, hearing this over and over again, it did occur to me that saying that being a Jew has nothing to do with it is a very Jewish thing to say, particularly in America. where Jews are free to be American, as opposed to a hyphenate, you know, a Jewish American, a French Jew, a German Jew. So Jewishness was one of the currencies that was traded, I think, as Jews became Americans and as America became more Jewish, which I think over the last century was really one of the major phenomenons that we can trace. Not only that the Jews were looking for America, but that America was looking for the Jews.
You know, it reminds me, in an odd sort of way, Central Europe was, the Central European culture was so extraordinarily a Jewish Central European culture, and they say that sort of when the Jews left, and the approach of Hitler, and then of course the Holocaust, all of Central European culture sort of evaporated, like nothing new and creative happened. Those Jews came to America and helped to forge American culture in a larger way, creation of Hollywood, creation of so many, the music industry. I mean, you can sort of trace it all the way through. What do you think, is there anything uniquely Jewish besides this ability to accept freedom that the Jews brought with them into the music business?
Well, I think there is, and I think if you look carefully, you can see it throughout the popular music of the 20th century, and that is this concept of the Jewish narrative. Looking back at historically what the Jews provided to modern civilization, of course, you know, there's this idea of an ongoing alienation to the other guy. You are the other guy, and you have an obligation to look after the health and well-being of your fellow citizens, your fellow people, which is at the root of social justice when you think about it, and it's a very Jewish thing. I think the Jewish culture is at the root of a lot of Western faith and philosophy. But more than that, and maybe less than that, is this idea of a narrative. You know, I mean, the possibility exists that God does not exist. We all know that. And Jews are among the few people who can still be good religious people and still have their doubts. And this idea of skepticism and doubt is very much a part of the Jewish tradition. You know, they say the Jews are the people of the book, but it seems that the book is not so much the Torah, but the Talmud, the endless discussions, the conversation, this ongoing participation in a group narrative. So, I know that sounds like a great diversion, but to bring it up to date, if you look at what a popular song is in America, it's generally about a boy falling in love with a girl or vice versa. There's this little sliver of caring, two people caring for each other at the heart of this narrative. And stepping back and getting a macro view of the Jewish experience, it's the same thing. It's all about caring for one another. And so I think what the Jews did contribute is this idea of ordinary people caring for one another and in so participating, not only fulfilling a destiny, but creating a very modern and very American culture in the process.
You know, I remember interviewing Neil Sedaka on this show and talking about the Brill Building and all of the great creativities going on in there, and almost all of those people were Jewish.
they were Jewish. And people say, well, in the 50s, it was all rock and roll and Elvis Presley, and it was a very country, southern, Christian presentation, but just below the surface, there were these teams of Jewish songwriters at the Brill Building in New York turning out hit after hit after hit.
Neil Diamond and Carole King and Paul Simon and, I mean, on and on and on.
On and on. On and on. Lieber and Stoller, who wrote all the Elvis hits.
That's right. Yeah, in fact, writing this stuff for Elvis. Let's talk about music a little bit. It always impressed me that jazz fit Jews really well, because cantorial music is improvisational by nature, although, you know, Jews became instrumentalists. Klezmer music is kind of improvisational, too. Is that true? Did that influence you at all?
Well, certainly true. I don't know if I was influenced by klezmer aspects, but I was definitely influenced as a jazz musician by liturgical experience, the chanting primarily. You know, I have a very clear memory as a boy in the shul on a Saturday morning listening to these immigrants with the talis over their heads chanting and just rocking and having the experience of being in a room with a bunch of people just kind of rocking and being kind of synchronized through the breath, through the voice, through the movement, which felt to me at the time like some special experience that I wanted to follow, and I think I did follow it through jazz. I think the jazz experience was very similar as it played out, and so in a way my Jewish experience, my early Jewish experience, really was a jazz experience.
In researching your book and writing about Jews' music and the American dream, what was the most surprising discovery you made?
I guess the most surprising discovery probably was the relationship of Louis Armstrong to the Jewish community. I had no idea. And like everybody who had been a jazz fan, the received wisdom was that Louis Armstrong got his first trumpet when he was at the Colored Waif's home in New Orleans, and that his experience was very much an African-American experience. And to discover that he was really taken in by the Karnofskys, the Jewish family, that they bought him his first trumpet, that he himself said that listening to Mrs. Karnofsky sing Russian lullabies to the baby at night was what influenced him as a singer. It was moving to understand this connection of Jews and blacks in America, and I think one of the great sadnesses of the 20th century was the disruption of this great coming together of blacks and Jews. You know, when the Jews came to the United States, they were considered blacks as well.
Of course.
So, I mean, it's very hard for us to look back and just feel what it must have felt like back then to be a Jewish immigrant, to be part of this experience, to identify with the poorest of America's poor, to have a narrative of slavery to share. Because when you think about it, the black Americans, they had no literature. They had no written tradition. It was completely an oral tradition. And they had no framework for what was happening to them in America. And the Jews came and offered a framework. And so a lot of Jewish imagery, the River Jordan, many things, it plays out through black America. So this was, I think, maybe the most moving pivot point that I came upon, this connection of blacks and Jews, specifically through Louis Armstrong.
Yeah, fascinating. Again, I should mention in this season, so many of the Christmas songs were actually written by Jews. And I always felt this was a commercial enterprise, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, it wasn't just a commercial enterprise, though, because I think that when you listen to White Christmas, even though it's a It reduces, as Philip Roth said, the holiday to a song about snow.
Yes.
At the same time, it's a song about longing for a place that's gone. You know, there's a real kind of underlying Yiddish.
There's some schmaltz in there.
There's some schmaltz in there that is not part of the Catholic liturgy. I'm sorry.
I want to thank Ben Sidran for a great visit here on Too Jewish. The book is called There Was a Fire, Jews, Music, and the American Dream. It's available on Amazon and everywhere else. Where else can people go to find out more about your work?
Well, the simplest way is if you go to bensidran.com, it'll link you to all the ways you can buy the book, from Kindle downloads to autographed copies or whatever. So that's your one-stop shop.
Thanks very much, Ben. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be John Levinson, Harvard professor and author of the wonderful new book, Inheriting Abraham, The Legacy of the Patriarch in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Our playout this morning comes in honor of the new year of 2013, secular style, from Dudu Fisher, his classic Shana Tova, a good, happy, healthy new year. My friends, may you be blessed as well with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace. Yamim holchim, yamim baim, silchi gam at lachataim, rab icholim, simchi noflim, bechesed uverah.